Good morning. We welcome all of you this morning, but a special welcome goes to the students from Edgar High School. Would they please stand?
Wow.
They grew.
Oh, and their instructor was part of our Teachers Institute. Mm-hmm. We're delighted to have you all here with us today. You may all be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program called Court with Class. Students are across the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. And if the invitation is accepted, they are sent briefs in the case we are about to hear. They may engage in some activities relating to that case. They come for an oral argument. And after this second case, they will be joined by other students who were here earlier, and there will be a discussion with a justice of this court relating to the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case. If anyone would like a summary of the facts and legal issue presented, if you raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. All right, let me introduce the court to you all since we've met you. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. He is the justice with whom you will meet after this case. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her immediate right is an empty chair. And David Prosser usually sits there, but he will not be participating in this case. And on the far right is Justice Lewis Butler. On the far left is Justice Annette Ziegler, and seated next to Justice Ziegler is Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, I'll call the second case, which is 2006AP 291, Hornback versus the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, arguing on behalf of the plaintiffs, Hornback et al., is Mercy Hamilton. And I'm just going to call the roll for a moment. Then arguing on behalf of the Archdiocese will be John A. Rothstein and Donald L. Heaney. One is the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, Mr. Rothstein, the Archdiocese of the Diocese of Madison, Mr. Heaney, and then you have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Ms. Hamilton. Ms. Hamilton, you're from Pennsylvania, licensed there. You've appeared before us before, and you are going to be introduced by Wendy Gunderson, who just argued the case. Ms. Gunderson.
I'm bringing notes since I don't remember my name at this point.
start out with that. Come on, you can do it.
May it please the court. My name is Wendy Gunderson, and I represent the appellants in this case, representing Kenneth Hornback, Dennis Bolton, Ronald Kuhl, David Schaefer, and Glenn Bond. I'm here to introduce Marcy Hamilton. Attorney Hamilton is an attorney licensed to practice law in the state of Pennsylvania and the District of Columbia, and she is in good standing with those courts. She is a professor of law and frequently writes and lectures in the field of church and state relations. She was admitted pro hac vice by this court's order of January 18th of this year. She has argued twice before to this court, in 2003 in the case of John Doe 67C, and just last April in John Doe 1. I'm honored to introduce Attorney Hamilton to present the argument on behalf of the appellants.
Thank you, Attorney Gunderson. You did very well. Ms. Hamilton, welcome back. And you know the rules. We allow you to argue pro hac vici in this case and then say thank you, but you're no longer authorized to represent anyone. So with that understood, Ms. Hamilton, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Marcy Hamilton, and I represent the five plaintiffs in this case. The procedural posture of this case actually determines its outcome. This case comes to this court on a motion to dismiss. All allegations, along with their reasonable inferences, must be taken as true. Now, the defendants argue that the complaint is insufficient on policy grounds, but their argument is premature. This court has made it very clear that there must be some factual resolution before those kinds of public policy arguments are to be addressed. Now, there has been no fact-finding in this case. The complaint was filed. The defendants refused to file an answer, opposed discovery, and in 18 days, the case was dismissed. So the question in the case, especially in light of John Doe 1, is whether or not this complaint is sufficient to survive a motion to dismiss. And it is the plaintiff's position that it is more than sufficient because the theory of the complaint is that there has been a negligent failure to warn about a known child abuser.
Counselor, when I was preparing for this argument, I looked to see if I could find any case where we have said, yes, in Wisconsin, there is a cause of action for a negligent failure to warn. In John Doe, we had an intentional affirmative act. We didn't address whether an intentional failure to warn would lie. But this case is yet one step further. And frankly, I couldn't find a case where we said, yes, in Wisconsin, there is a cause of action for a negligent failure to warn. Did you find one?
Your Honor, that would probably be our fault. We understated our case in our reply brief. The case that is most helpful to us is the Gritzner case, which was decided in 2000, in which a majority of the court said that the theory of a negligent failure to warn would survive a complaint and a motion to dismiss. The question in that case was involved children as well, but the open question was whether or not the public policy would preclude failure to warn in those circumstances. But what the court did was to remand it back to the lower court for a determination of the factual resolution of really what kind of failure was there, what were the full facts of the case, then there would be a consideration of public policy. So, yes, there is a case. It's in 2000. It's quite helpful. On page 5, we understate the holding, actually, and I apologize for that.
So your position, at least on the duty and failure to warn, is that should go back?
Yes. Yes, that should go back, in part because Wisconsin is a very interesting state in that it is a state that's rejected the majority opinion in Paul's Graph. So that Wisconsin is a state where you do not have to have a readily identifiable plaintiff in order to establish a duty. And it's that element in Wisconsin law that makes this complaint particularly strong.
Counselor, but here you're not really saying there was a failure to warn the plaintiffs. You're saying there was a failure to warn a subsequent employer, and from that were to determine that if you'd warned the subsequent employer, it would have prevented the harm. So you're one step further yet again, aren't you?
But there's a failure to warn third parties, whether it is the employer in Kentucky, the diocese in Kentucky, the parents or the students in Kentucky is an open question that would be part of the discovery process. But failure to warn third parties in the Schuster case in this court is a theory that has survived a motion to dismiss and has also survived a summary judgment motion. So, and that's where this court's rule that you don't have to have a readily identifiable plaintiff, it's actually there is a duty to third parties that's raised in the state of Wisconsin. It is not a duty you see across the country, but in the state of Wisconsin, in this court's rules, it's actually a viable theory. And that's all we need to have at this point. This is, we have had no fact-finding whatsoever, and we have sufficient facts at least to establish that there were a quantum of facts which provided clear knowledge to both of the archdioceses that they had a known sex abuser in their midst. And with respect to one, they knew that there were 24 victims, and with the other, up to 10 victims. And the question is, in this state, is it possible in those circumstances to say that there is a duty to warn, especially within the same institution? This teacher did not go outside of the Roman Catholic Church's institutions.
He was not a member of the clergy, though.
No, he was not. He was a lay teacher in Catholic schools throughout.
Does it matter to your complaint that a promise was made to people that there would be warnings?
The Milwaukee Archdiocese made a promise that not only would it provide reporting, but that it would also make sure that this particular individual was never near another child. That promise is part of a duty to warn. It's evidence that they had knowledge and that they had an obligation to do something. This case obviously has not been brought by those parents that they directly spoke to, but that's not an issue for us because of the doctrine in this court that third parties are acceptable plaintiffs.
Well, the doctrine is that there's a duty to everyone in the world.
Yeah.
That's what you're
essentially
talking about.
Essentially, in Wisconsin, that is the doctrine.
That's the doctrine you're talking about.
If there is a known child abuser, that seems to be pretty clear in the cases.
Or maybe the statutes, too.
The statutes, too, but with respect to this case, I take it that the statute provides the 3-year limit, which we've satisfied with the complaint. And then the question for this court is, when does the claim accrue? And that's based on this court's determination of, first, the sufficiency of the complaint on a theory, and then later on down the road, whether or not public policy would permit recovery. But that's far down the procedural path from where we are today.
In responding to the Chief's question, you mentioned the promise that there would be warnings and that that's evidence of a duty to warn. Given that promise that was made, at least with respect to the Archdiocese, does that in any way draw a distinction with your claim between that which is made with the Diocese of Madison? I mean, are there really two different things going on here?
There's no question that the complaint states that the Archdiocese of Milwaukee made clear promises. The Archdiocese of Madison did not, although the complaint does allege their knowledge. And it's the basis of the duty to warn claim is the knowledge of sexual abuse, which is what the Grincer case held.
So from your perspective, it's not the promise that matters, it's the knowledge.
The promise only reinforces the fact that they knew. So we have, not only did they have knowledge, but they expressed that knowledge to others. And so it's just a quantum of evidence as to whether or not they had knowledge. And all the facts go to the knowledge issue.
Ms. Hamilton, as I read the briefs, I got the impression there was a mighty effort being made to attempt to bring this case within a John Doe 1, to claim that somehow or other there was fraud here. Are you seriously arguing that the complaint contains an allegation of fraud?
No, Your Honor, no. Fraud is not adequately alleged in this complaint. What John Doe 1 did is it stated that there is a claim, that's an intentional misrepresentation, that can survive and not accrue until well after the last sexual assault. But it also then clumped together the employment relationship claims, so negligent supervision, retention, and said, now those all, as a matter of law, they accrue as of the last sexual attack. The vast array of tort theories in between, I would treat those as the two ends of the spectrum. This court has not yet addressed. It's our position that the failure to warn in this case falls far, far down the line toward the fraud idea. And it's not in the employment universe. We are not asking a question about whether an employer has handled an employee appropriately or negligently or otherwise. The question here is the independent acts of these archdioceses with respect to their knowledge of a child abuser and not with respect to any employee within their midst.
It's a fine line, isn't it?
I don't know if it's as fine a line. I think we could have a worse case. The employment universe is so settled by now that we know it's negligent hiring, retention, and supervision. We hear that over and over again. It's clear that those cases in John Doe 1 are beyond any kind of pleading success we might have. But this is a case where it's not a question of knowledge. It's not even gray, according to the complaint, you take it as true, there was clear knowledge. And it wasn't just knowledge about an incident. It was a knowledge of 24 survivors and then up to 10 survivors. That's a lot of knowledge about one sex abuse event, individual. And if you look at Grinsner, what it says is that knowledge of sexual abuse by an individual is sufficient to establish the duty to warn. And then the rest of the Wisconsin tort doctrine that permits and requires liability to third parties completes the theory, actually. So essentially, this is a procedural case. It's a motion to dismiss case. All the public policy considerations that the defendants would like us to consider are simply farther down the line.
So if it's a knowledge of sexual abuse duty to warn, it's not higher retention or supervision. They hired him. They retained him. They supervised him, and they fired him.
Right.
Or he
right.
was let go of one sort or other. So you're saying it's not an employment case. So it becomes that A has knowledge of sexual abuse and fails to warn.
And knowledge of quite serious sexual abuse and fails to warn.
Okay. And it so happens that the knowledge is in an employment situation.
Well, it happens that they learn it out of an employment situation, but the plaintiffs are not involved in that employment situation. Now, the plaintiffs have already brought their employment claims against the Archdiocese of Louisville. Those are settled. They've already brought their claim against the perpetrator. He's in jail. And so that's not what this case is about. This case is about the defendants that these particular plaintiffs could never have imagined. Right? These are two defendants engaging in activity that are not within these plaintiffs' universe. And so for this court, the question is can there be liability from these two defendants to these individuals? And our argument is that Grinsner, along with the rule of liability to third parties, makes that a very viable claim.
You were here in the last argument, were you not?
Yes, I was.
Okay. This has some rings some bells that are similar, seems to me. First of all, you've got the wrongdoer did an intentional act, right?
Yes.
And the plaintiffs have recovered from the wrongdoer for their damages from the...
From the perpetrator?
From the perpetrator.
From a wrongdoer, yes.
That's right. There are several wrongdoers alleged. Anyway. So he's recovered from them. Now, this is another wrongdoer, and it's a negligent wrongdoer. So we got intentional wrongdoer, negligent wrongdoer. We got two different lawsuits instead of one lawsuit. Why are you not barred? Because you've already recovered.
Because this court has followed the rule in SOFA, which is in the asbestos cases, which is that there is no requirement of claim grouping in any one case, that if the facts do not appear at a certain time, the plaintiff cannot be required to go to court without the knowledge and the identity of the tortfeasor. So SOFA actually speaks directly to that issue, but also Spittler speaks to the issue of whether or not a plaintiff is required to go into court in that case through the law that says you can have a you don't even name the defendant, but you make sure you get into court without knowing who it is. And in Spittler, the court says no. Even that opportunity does not make it that the accrual has happened. Rather, the accrual doesn't happen until you know who your tortfeasor is.
And the assumption is you haven't been fully paid for the damage. Because if you've been fully paid from Z, then you got a contribution kind of issue, which is not your concern.
Right. Right. Well, it also, there's two different kinds of damage here as well. I mean, the different wrongdoers have engaged in different tortious activity.
Maybe, but isn't there a single damage?
That's beyond my area of competence, I'll have to admit.
Counsel, may I ask, the causal connection between the Milwaukee and Madison archdiocese, their negligence, and then the subsequent injury, I know you say in paragraph 26 of the complaint that the negligent conduct of the two archdioceses was a substantial factor in causing the sexual abuse of the plaintiffs. Where's the nexus between their negligence and somewhere down the line, and then 30 years later, discovering that nexus? Where's that factor in?
Well, the nexus in this case is actually between the fact that this has all happened within a single institution. We might have a different case if the next school that he found in Kentucky was a public school. But what we have is a series of private parochial schools in which this individual has abused children seriatim. And so, you know, implicit in your question is some concern about where you draw the line, how do we keep this from going too far? That's a legitimate question, but it's really the sixth factor in the public policy analysis this court would apply after there's been fact-finding. It's a sort of issue that's not supposed to appear with respect to the complaint. It's a sort of issue you would take up with respect to summary judgment.
Where's the causal connection? Where's the nexus between Milwaukee and Madison and the Kentucky abuse?
The nexus is the perpetrator. It's the entity. It's the obvious hazard that these two archdioceses did not warn about, even though they knew full well the identity of the child abuser. And they knew that he had a propensity to be a teacher and a coach. He did not even change his career path when he left the state. And in addition, he was encouraged by the Archdiocese here in Wisconsin to leave quietly.
Counselor, what if, you know, these are separate corporations. These different archdioceses are not one and the same entity. And what if you had someone who was abusing patients as a nurse at St. Mary's Hospital, and then that person went down to St. Louis and worked in a hospital in St. Louis, and there was no warning by St. Mary's, and this is a nurse that you know she's going to find another place to work, likely with the same kind of background, and she does it again. And then she moves to Kentucky to a hospital there and abuses patients there. I mean, if we agree with you, aren't we opening a very, very broad door here in tort law for every employer to be responsible for what happens with any employee who is doing abuse with subsequent acts that they have no knowledge of and no control over?
Well, I actually have two answers to that. And one is that the complaint does not go beyond a single institution, the Roman Catholic Church.
Well, it's not a single institution, though. You say in your complaint that they're separate corporations. You allege that yourself.
They are separate corporations under an umbrella. There's no question that they are clearly linked. But that's all premature. The question you're asking me is, where do we stop this? Where do we stop the theory that is based on this court's decisions? And the answer is, we don't do it at the motion to dismiss. That inquiry is inappropriate at this level. The public policy considerations and what you've described is the sixth one, whether recovery in this case could be defined or limited through some just stopping point, that's an issue to be decided on summary judgment. The Sawyer case considered those issues, but that was a summary judgment determination. Those are public policy issues that are not part of the original identification of what the theory is. And so our position is that we've pled a theory. The question after fact resolution will be, is it consistent with public policy to permit recovery? But that's significantly farther down the line procedurally. We're just not to that point yet. What the Grinsner Court says is, once there are adequate facts of knowledge of this sex abuse, then you send it back to the lower court for fact-finding.
Counsel, I want to focus on two cases, Grinsner and Schuster, and you've mentioned
yes.
both of them. And also, not only the facts, but then this public policy limitation of liability. As I understand it, Grinsner involved a failure to warn claim with regard to, if I remember, the child was maybe Tara. I mean, there was a specific
yeah.
child involved. And the court in that case said it was not right for public policy limitation and sent it back for development of fact-finding. The Schuster case, which was written by Justice Cece, I think. Anyway, the Schuster case dealt with unknown victims, as you were commenting on in a more general sense earlier. And that was a failure to warn. It involved maybe a psychotherapist, and there were negligent treatment claims or diagnosis and treatment. But the court said this failure to warn third parties was a separate cause of action recognized in the state of Wisconsin, and then looked at the public policy factors and also said, you got to have here a factual determination before you preclude liability in public policy. But I'll tell you, there are lots of cases. This happens to be the two cases that are our genre of failure, a recent genre of failure to disclose or failure to warn, send it back. But we have a lot of cases that where we apply public policy here. Why should, if there is negligence, and I'm going to say that hypothetically, why wouldn't we apply public policy factors here and arguably apply the last one that was referred to, no just stopping point?
Well, the problem...
And what, if any, difference in facts between the Archdiocese and Madison, Archdiocese representing that they're going to tell others, if that plays any part at all? Now, I've made my question quite complex. You think you're ready for it?
The way this court has laid out the public policy consideration criteria makes it very hard at this point, right? Now, Gritzner is a 2000 case. It's a relatively recent case. But the way they've been laid out, it's really hard to make any conclusion unless you have the facts of the case before you, after discovery, after at least you're at the point of a summary judgment motion. I mean, if I may, it's just the injury must be too remote from the negligence, or the injury is too wholly out of proportion to culpability of the negligent tortfeasor. In retrospect, it appears too highly extraordinary. The negligence should have brought about harm. I mean, these are fact-based questions that are hard to answer in the abstract. Now, obviously, we'd love it if you said as a public policy, this is a fine theory. But I think the way this court has set up these criteria, it's hard for you to apply them on the basis of just a complaint.
Are you making the distinction between summary judgment and motion to dismiss?
Yes.
Did you find any case that in a motion to dismiss applied public policy?
Not directly. Where you see the fullest application of these factors is in the Sawyer case, but that's a summary judgment case. And I looked.
That's because then you do have evidentiary matters,
right,
et cetera, and
right,
that
right,
we, I mean, use. That's your position, that not on motion to dismiss, maybe on summary judgment, and clearly after a decision on the facts.
Right, right. I mean, public policy requires factual knowledge.
Hamilton, you've talked about Gritzner several times, and I haven't read the entire opinion again, but looking at the opinion, I'm having some trouble with what I believe you've been arguing. Gritzner seems to make it clear that public policy precludes the Gritzner's claim for negligent failure to warn. It says public policy does not preclude the negligent failure to control, but it draws that distinction. And by the way, it is a case that came to us, as I understand it, on a motion to dismiss from the lower court. Now, am I misreading what you've been saying?
It's a very confusing case to read, Your Honor. What that case has is the majority of the court says that there is a failure to control claim sufficient in the complaint, sends that back. Then at the end of the opinion, there's a concurrence, but it's a concurrence of 5 votes that sends back the failure to warn claim. So there's this dictum early in the original part of the opinion, which everybody's on, which says, you know, there may not be this theory, but then there's a concurrence in the end that says, written by Madam Chief Justice Abrahamson, that says we do send it back on a failure to warn claim.
That's a concurrence that I joined, if I'm reading this correctly.
Yes. And had more than four votes.
Yes, you got five votes.
Yes,
I have to tell you, the first time I read that case, I completely agreed with you because that dictum comes before the majority opinion. It's very confusing, but once working through it many, many times, I realized it was a better case than I thought it was.
So it looks like we had a lead opinion, but then we had a concurring opinion that turns out to be the majority.
That got the votes, right,
okay.
Right.
Thank you.
no, I have exactly the same problem. So,
do you have a question?
I'll say that.
Okay.
All right,
thank you.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Ms. Hamilton. Mr. Rothstein, representing the Archdiocese of Milwaukee.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am John Rothstein, and I represent the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. Sitting to the left of me is Don Heaney, who is going to be providing argument on behalf of the Diocese of Madison. And we split our argument 15 minutes each. I believe there are seven salient facts that I want to state first that I think are important for the court to appreciate, and then I will state what I believe are the two issues for the court. The seven facts. Who are the plaintiffs? These are five plaintiffs. They're from Kentucky. The abuse they allege occurred in Kentucky. Two, age of events. The events that these plaintiffs allege, the soonest event was 35 years ago. Three, age of the plaintiffs. How old were the plaintiffs when this lawsuit was commenced? The lawsuit was commenced in 2005. The youngest plaintiff at that time was 40 years, and all the rest were that or older. Four, employer of the abuser. Who was the employer? The employer at the time, the party with supervision and control, was a school in Kentucky by the name of Our Mother of Sorrows. As plaintiff's counsel has indicated, there was a suit against that direct employer under supervision and control and a recovery. Five, the accused. This is important. The accused was not a minister, not a priest, not a cleric. This is not a religious case at all. This is an employment case. This was a lay teacher. This has to do with what the duties of an employer are to an employee. It just so happens that it was the Archdiocese case. It's religious, but this is a lay employee, nothing more than that. Six, no recommendations or contacts by Madison or Milwaukee as former employers. It is clear from the complaint, there's no allegation that at or during the time of this individual's employment, is there any assertion that either Milwaukee or Madison made any statement, sent any letter of recommendation, or were asked any comments, or even knew that this employee was in Kentucky? And seven, no reliance. Again, the plaintiffs affirmatively assert, you heard it today, that they had no knowledge of anything Madison or Milwaukee did as ex-employers until years later. The point being, nothing that was done at the time that they were in school in Kentucky had any effect based upon what Milwaukee or Madison did or did not do. What are the two issues for the court? The two issues are this. One, this Mr. Heaney will address, but I think it's controlling. This court decided the John Doe case just last year, actually less than 9 months ago, July 11th, a little over 8 months ago. And unless this court overrules that precedent, I believe that that precedent forecloses this case. That case held that negligence claims are derivative and arise at the same time as the claim against the perpetrator. This is another derivative claim against another employer, albeit a far more removed employer. In the case of Milwaukee, twice removed. In the case of Madison, once removed. Mr. Haney will address the stare decisis. Two, what is the second question? The employment question. As I said, this is not a religious case. This is an employment case. And because there is no allegation of any recommendation or contact with Madison and Milwaukee, this court is going to have to decide, if you choose to overrule John Doe 1, which I believe there's no basis to do, given the recent case law. But this would be the employment question. Is the law of this state going to impose on ex-employers an obligation to search out and to disclose to all potential subsequent employers or to the public at large matters concerning an ex-employee's history? Do we have to search out as employers? And that's whether it's Milwaukee or Madison. The black letter law on this issue has been, it's not been decided by this court, it has been decided by other courts. The leading case, I think, in the United States is Randy W. versus Murak out of California, decided 11 years ago. And the facts in there are strikingly similar. There was a minor, 13-year-old, sexually abused by an administrator in a school. Two, this administrator had come to that school with prior history of prior working as an employee in other school districts. Three, and this is the distinguishing factor, those prior school districts not only knew of sexual abuse by this individual when that individual was in their employ, but they went out and they sent a letter of recommendation. They had been contacted. They sent a letter of recommendation which was politely saying misleading. They had sent a letter that suggested that this would be a good teacher, that this would be safe, and that they could recommend them. That's the distinguishing feature. The holding of the court was this in Randy. As a general matter, employers have no obligation to seek out and find new employers of ex-employees, to advise them independently of any bad acts or characteristics of employers. There's just no obligation to do that. But if an employer takes it upon themselves to make a recommendation, then they have to do so fully and completely. And if they fail to do so, and if that school district, in reliance upon that, hires that individual, there is a cause of action for the students in that school which relied upon the letter to sue.
Does California adopt the majority or the minority of Paul's graph?
It adopts the same rule, it was discussed in Randy, as the Wisconsin rule set forth in Gritzner, that if you have a duty, it's a duty to the world.
One of the things that I had the opportunity to do this morning is to read the Schuster case. And it seems to me that case indicates that Wisconsin, because it's, and the reason I ask about the minority rule in Paul's graph, because it discusses the minority rule in Paul's graph extensively in that opinion. And then it says that Wisconsin recognizes the failure to warn a third party cause of action. So my question to you is, are you arguing for an employer exception to the Schuster case, or has the Schuster case been overruled, or am I misreading the Schuster case?
Your Honor, I believe this. I think there's a confusion with respect to the causes of action that could be brought. Randy's a good example in response to your question. In Randy, there were several claims brought against the prior employers. One was fraud, because affirmative representations were made that were relied upon to the detriment of that school and that individual, as well as negligent misrepresentation. The important part is this, if I'm catching my train of thought. In both instances, there has to be detrimental reliance. The individual and the school has to rely upon...
Let me return to my question, and let me break it up, because sometimes I make my questions too long and complex. Do you think that Schuster stands for the proposition that in Wisconsin we recognize a failure to warn cause of action vis-a-vis third parties?
Only if there's reliance, Your Honor. I can't answer.
And I don't know the answer to this question, do you think the Schuster decision makes any reference whatsoever to reliance?
I can't say that.
I can't say that either, because my read was rather quick, but I don't recall any discussion regarding alliance. So let me just assume hypothetically that there's no discussion in Schuster regarding reliance. Do you want us to change the law in Wisconsin set forth in Schuster to add some reliance in it then, to be more like the California case that you're talking about?
Well, in Wisconsin, I believe this is the law. If you're suing in fraud, misrepresentation, mm-hmm. and all those, the jury instructions will say. And the John Doe 1 case will say, with respect to fraud, there are five elements.
Schuster was at a couple, but the cause of action that was of import with regard to the failure to warn third parties was a cause of action in negligence.
With respect to failure to warn in Wisconsin, Gritzner's the one that you just brought up. I'll use that.
And that's first person, not third person,
right.
It seems to me. This is third party, though.
And if I can get to it in this fashion, in Gritzner, that question was left open because why? In that instance, the policy reasons which you mentioned are there, it was a next-door neighbor where they could cite that the next-door neighbor was the local parent. Two, that the abuse occurred on the premises of the various individual being sued. Three, that the individual being sued allegedly had control. These are policy factors which allowed the court to say, under those circumstances, local parent on the premises with control, there is now a duty to warn.
How do you distinguish Schuster, then, if you don't want to apply it?
I'm not familiar enough with Schuster to tell you, Your Honor.
Okay.
The policy reasons I wanted to get to is it's very clear.
Mr. Rothstein, before you do that, does it make any difference here that the complaint alleges that there were promises made to parents that this guy would not have contact with children in the future? Does that change the dichotomy here as far as the duty to warn?
No. And I can tell the court two reasons. One, those allegations, as Mr. Haney will explain, are made strictly against Milwaukee. If you separate those out, now you have the pure legal question of do you have a duty to report to police or do you have a duty to report to subsequent. So it's a straw man. Regardless, I will now answer the question, does it matter for Milwaukee? And the answer is no. The allegations are is that Milwaukee promised parents in Milwaukee that this individual would receive treatment and not be put in a teaching position again. If any Milwaukee parents sued for fraud or for negligent misrepresentation, they would have to prove the elements of a representation that was false, that was relied upon to their detriment. And that's the very reason these plaintiffs cannot allege these causes of action, because they can't get past the fact for Milwaukee is that whatever Milwaukee said to a Milwaukee parent, they never heard. They admit that. They never relied upon. So they cannot use any of the misrepresentation counts that they've sort of added as a diversionary thing. It adds a pejorative sense, but in terms of a cause of action, it doesn't improve their position at all, because what they cannot allege, because they want to say, we didn't know about Milwaukee or Madison for the statute of limitation, but the consequence of that is that if you didn't know about Milwaukee or Madison, clearly what you did 20 years ago had no bearing. There was no reliance upon you, whatever Milwaukee did or didn't do. So back to your question. Does it matter for Milwaukee? The answer is no, because those are diversionary proceedings. They can't prove reliance by their very claims of no knowledge. They didn't go to those schools or not to. And
aren't they third-party beneficiaries of an agreement?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Again, if I to give you an example in using the Randy case, if I send out a letter of recommendation to School A, and School A gets it, and they hire this individual, and he abuses, there's liability now. Mm-hmm. But if School B, 5 years later, who's never seen that letter, who's never seen it, doesn't know about the letter, they hire him. They have no basis to say, well, I'm a third-party beneficiary. Not unless you detrimentally relied somehow. There's no causation. There's no duty. And that's why it comes back to, in terms of this decision for the court, this court has to decide whether you're going to tax every employer in the state with following every bad employee. In this case, these events took place anywhere between 2 years and 7 years after this employee left Milwaukee.
Well, let's say that the employer was Dow Chemical, and they have plants all over the country and all over the world, and Dow Chemical says, don't sue us for this sexual abuse that a high corporate officer engaged in, and that we might have been negligent in supervising. We are going to fire him, and we guarantee to you that Dow Chemical is not going to allow him anywhere near children. And then another subsidiary Dow or another plant of Dow's, another part of the country, another part of the world, hires this guy, puts him in a position where he can assault children. Is Dow Chemical going to be liable?
I understand the question. Has this individual moved from one Dow position to another Dow position? I think that's back to the case you've already decided. John Doe 1, you held in John Doe 1, that's a representation. If you're the same employer and you switch them around.
But part of this complaint, as I understand Ms. Hamilton, is that people view the church, whether it's true or not, as an international entity with a head person recognized across the world by all religions as the head of the Roman Catholic Church, and that messages go from the head person and control what's done, or they hope to control, whether they actually do is another issue, all of the parishes, all of the members of the church, and the head person doesn't, he or they appoint archbishops and bishops and et cetera.
Your Honor.
So, I mean, what's the difference between Dow Chemical?
Two very important issues. One, that's not been pled. Two, if this court were to adopt and to allow such allegations, I think now we have a First Amendment problem. If you were to say that the
and Catholic, you have what?
A First Amendment problem.
Okay.
I don't believe there's any First Amendment issues in there. And the reason is that whether you are a Methodist, a Jewish, a Episcopal, whatever church, you have the right to your religious beliefs. But you also live in the real world. You have employees. You have janitors. You have electricians, etc. They, as an employer, have no basis to be treated more poorly or to be given a presumption that anybody who works for you now responds to the Pope. If there were such a basis of a ruling, now I think you would have a First Amendment. Mm-hmm. This is an employment question. It's undisputed. Mm-hmm. This individual was simply a lay teacher who left Milwaukee, chose to go to a different area, Madison, chose to go out of state to Kentucky years later and teach there. And that's why this is an employment question. It cannot be a religious question.
Mm-hmm. So the church is different than Dow Chemical in that sense?
No. It's in the sense that it is an employer, it is precisely the same and may not be treated differently.
Well, but you answered that if Dow Chemical and Plant A made the promise, and then the guy is hired Plant Z, that maybe Dow Chemical would be liable.
Yes, Your Honor, because in the same circumstance, you've already held in John Doe 1 on a fraud count, if a religious institution takes an individual in one of their places and puts it in another, there's liability. Well, that'd be true for Dow Chemical, I would hope, as it is for the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. But when it comes to an employee and Dow Chemical and the Archdiocese, they can be no different. This is not a religious case. There can be no greater obligation for ex-employees placed upon a church because it's a church versus Dow Chemical. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Haney, representing the Diocese of Madison.
May it please the court. My name is Donald Heaney, and I represent the Diocese of Madison. My position is that the action is barred by the statute of limitations. The core of my position lies in Doe 1 versus Archdiocese of Milwaukee, which was decided on July 11th of 2007. My original outline, which I have before me, indicated that I have 2 points to make. I'm now going to truncate the first point. My first point was originally that the plaintiffs have not pleaded a case for fraud. I think that's been clearly conceded already. But I would like to say a word or two about what was originally my first point, because it illustrates the shifting sands of the plaintiffs' arguments in this case. As Justice Crooks pointed out earlier, for a while it looked as if there was an effort to prove that fraud had been committed by these two dioceses. And, in fact, there was an allegation that both Madison and Milwaukee had made representations to parents. There is no such allegation in the complaint. But when I read the original brief of the plaintiffs, it said at page 20 that the Madison Diocese represented to parents that Kaczmarek would be sent to treatment and represented to parents Kaczmarek would never have contact with children again. That was not in the complaint. It was only stated in the brief at page 20. We naturally met that in our brief and said we did not ever make representations of any kind to anybody ever in this case.
Why are you emphatic about that? Does that make a difference? And if so, that plays into your other counsel's argument. But why are you emphatic that you never made representations? This is not about a fraud claim, as acquiesced by the plaintiff, and yet you must feel it important to note that, to get into the issue, even though it's not right now before it. So why is that important? And that's a distinction between Archdiocese and you. And so what moment is that distinction?
I think if I can say one more sentence about it, Your Honor, it will indicate why I'm even speaking about it here. Because after we made that correction, in their reply brief, the plaintiffs made the same allegation about Madison 10 times. I don't want this court to be misled because somebody keeps saying the same thing over and over again as to what the status of the record is. And that is simply my point on that.
Okay, but is there any difference between your position and the Archdiocese if the allegations against the Archdiocese is that they made representations to the parents?
My position on the facts is different. Because the facts are different.
Sure, but I'm talking about, is there any difference in the legal analysis? I mean, you've been focusing on that, so it must be of some import.
No,
so what is the import?
Excuse me.
Please.
I make no difference in the legal analysis between the Archdiocese of Milwaukee and the Diocese of Madison because of my second point, the one that I actually do intend to make here today. And that is that the plaintiffs have pleaded a derivative cause of action. That is what they pleaded. The derivative cause of action.
Mr. Heaney, let me ask you about that, because I wasn't quite certain that that was what was pleaded here. And I want to focus in on that, because there's three different paragraphs in the complaint, paragraphs 24, 26, and 27. 27 would support your argument that, at least with respect to that claim, that may be derivative. That's the plaintiffs first discovered Kaczmarek sexual abuse of children in the Milwaukee and Madison archdiocese, and those archdiocese negligent conduct in October of 2002. But when you look at 24 and 26, it talks about the Milwaukee archdiocese knew or should have known of Kaczmarek's propensity for sexually abusing children, and despite this knowledge, did not refer Kaczmarek to the police or take any other action to prevent him from continuing his pattern of sexually abusing children. Similar type references made in paragraph 26. Am I reading this incorrectly, or are they arguing with respect to at least paragraphs 24 and 26 that there is a separate cause of action based on their failure to warn and any supposed duty to warn that may not be derivative? As in a negligent supervision type case?
Both 24 and 26 refer to the statutory duty to warn. B.B. Doe, I think, answers that, Your Honor. And B.B. Doe I have listed here. I have it here. That's a 1997 decision, Your Honor, in which the courts held, this court held in 1997, that failing to report to police under section 49.781 is, quote, and I'm now quoting, merely derivative of the underlying intentional tort claims, and went on to say, and is therefore untimely. So I think, Your Honor, that really answers your question that case.
Let me just press you on that, Mr. Heaney, because quite frankly, I didn't go back and look at that case with that in mind before this argument, and I just want to make sure I understand your argument. As I understand, B.B. Doe was in the context of a negligent supervision action, correct?
That's right.
B.B. Doe was in the context of a negligent supervision action. Is that correct?
What kind of action?
Negligent supervision.
Yes.
And I guess my question here, we're dealing with plaintiffs in another jurisdiction, not here. And I'm wondering if what we're talking about here is negligent supervision, or if what we're talking about here is something different, an affirmative duty to warn. I think that's what's being argued here. And it may or may not make a difference to your argument, but one is clearly derivative. I'm not sure the other is clearly derivative, and that's why I'm pressing you on.
Your Honor is correct that B.B. Doe did provide, or there was an allegation of negligent supervision. There was also a specific allegation of failure to report under the statute. And therefore, I think the B.B. Doe holding is directly on point.
Thank you.
My basic underlying point on this, however, is to compare the opinion authored by Justice Rogensack in Doe 1, which provided in footnote 11 as follows. Accordingly, a claim against an employer for negligent supervision of an employee is derivative of an employee's wrongful act that causes injury to another, which wrongful act is alleged to have been caused by the employer's negligence. To state that another way, I don't claim to be able to say it better than Justice Rogensack could do, but I just did. But I'm just pointing out that you could say it a little differently, and this is how I say it. A claim against an employer is derivative if an employee's wrongful act that causes injury to another, when the wrongful act is alleged to have been caused by the employer's negligence. That is the formula set out by this court some 8 months ago. Now, contrast that with what was pleaded by the plaintiffs, not contrast, compare it, because there is no contrast, which was pleaded by the plaintiff. I'm quoting from paragraph 26 of the complaint, which is set out at the A-122. Here's what they alleged. The negligent conduct of the two archdioceses was a substantial factor in causing chasmeric sexual abuse of the plaintiffs, which has resulted in severe and permanent injuries to each of these men. That says exactly the same thing as the quote that I made from the opinion of this court in Doe 1. They have pleaded exactly the formula set out by this court some 8 months ago.
No, but what you read from Doe 1 was with regard to negligent supervision, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And we're not dealing with a negligent supervision claim here.
No.
Am I correct?
You are correct.
Yeah.
But they were simply there using the negligent supervision as an example. The sentence in context obviously goes to any derivative action. And as I add in my colloquy with Justice Butler, there clearly are a great many of these different kinds of derivative actions which accompany the horrendous act that ultimately results that brings us all here today. And so there's no real distinction on a derivative action between whether it's based on any one of a number of things that are derivative.
Fraud isn't the cause of action, and fraud on the same actions, though, would not be considered derivative.
Because this court has said that that's different from a derivative action.
Mm-hmm.
How is it different?
In all the ways that the majority said it was.
As you very well know, I dissented in that case.
I do know that, Your Honor.
And the reason I'm pushing you on it is I'm not so sure that fraud and negligence were different. I know what the majority said, but I don't see how they're different. Why don't you say an action is derivative if the wrongful act alleged was caused by the employer's fraud is derivative? In all of these cases, you'd have no liability of the employer unless the employee was liable. I'll put it a different way. Unless the employee committed a wrong. Because if the employee didn't commit a wrong, the fraud is irrelevant. If the employee didn't commit a wrong, the employer's negligence is irrelevant. So everything is derivative from the employee. Fraud, and negligence. Now, I didn't object to the fraud because I thought that the statute of limitations hadn't accrued. I only objected to saying the negligence was derivative. But tell me how you can explain the difference between fraud and negligence supervision, because you've got two poles in that case, right? And what the plaintiff says, whether she's right or not, that is, counsel is right or not, she says, well, you've got these two poles, and we fall in the middle here, or somewhere not on the two poles. So I can't tell if the argument is correct, unless you can explain to me why one is derivative and not another.
Your Honor, it's beyond my competence to take issue with a Chief Justice. So
that's a good answer, but not good enough.
I will go to higher authority. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who said, think things, not words. I think derivative may be what's causing problems.
Of course it's causing problems.
The rule is as I stated it, because this court said it was. That's really ultimately my argument.
That doesn't work. If you had a negligent failure, if you had a negligent supervision, you got precedent 9 months old. If you had fraud, you've got precedent 9 months old. Now you have a different case. It's neither negligence and supervision, nor is it fraud. And I can't tell where it fits, whether it's negligence or fraud, unless I can understand why one is derivative under that 2007 case and one isn't. So it seems to me, counsel, you can either say, I really don't know, but this is closer to negligence, and the court said it, and I'm sticking with it because precedent is precedent, right or wrong. Is that your answer?
Your Honor is struggling with a concept that ordinary lawyers like I am, very, very frequently struggle. We don't always understand how the court got to where it got. But the court did get there
in
John Doe.
I agree. They got there. I agree. Negligence is on one side. Fraud is on the other. Where does this fit? Where does this case fit? This is not negligent supervision, right? So it's a different case. Why do you think it fits closer to fraud, fits closer to negligent supervision than to fraud?
It's negligent because we must deal with the four corners of the complaint. And the plaintiffs have said over and over again, including in their complaint, that this is a negligence case. This is not a fraud case.
So all negligence, whether it's supervision or not, is derivative. That's your position.
That seems to be the holding of this court, yes.
You don't want to take that position.
Not if it's fraud. Fraud is different.
Fraud is different. But all negligence of an employer fits within that it's an accrual.
That's the way I read it.
That's the way you read it. Okay.
Just one quick question, if I may, Chief. I'm looking at paragraph 49 of Doe.
Which one? The
recent
2007? 49,
Doe 1.
Okay.
And it says in paragraph 49, we do not address the sufficiency of the plaintiff's fraudulent misrepresentation claims based on failures to disclose Wadera and Becker's history of sexual molesting. So in one hand, we have fraudulent misrepresentation, which we don't have any fraud alleged here, but it's based on failure to disclose, which is the assertion here. Do we have some kind of a hybrid in this case?
I'm not sure I'm following the context of this. Maybe if I had it before me, Your Honor.
That's right.
49. Why don't you read it?
I think that's based on an intentional failure to disclose, with all respect, according to what was pled. Mm-hmm. And we're now talking about a negligent failure to disclose.
Fair enough. I withdraw my question.
I think it's a different claim.
That's the best answer I've given all day.
I don't. I withdraw withdrawing my question, not necessarily because I agree with it, but it's 12:20 and your red light is on, and I'll look at it more carefully in the opinion.
There are three sentences in that paragraph 49. The reference is to the third sentence, and it does not say intentional. It just says affirmative fraudulent misrepresentations. So whether it's intentional or negligent or strict liability is not clear. But anyway, you can look at that. And the court will, of course, look at that, too.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Hamilton, what do you have to say about that?
What I'd like to say about that is that, I would have loved to have won on that point and John Doe won.
To apply it in this case.
The issue here is failure to warn unsuspecting plaintiffs. The question in the derivative cases involves a plaintiff that's in a situation that this court has said is a matter of law, can figure out by the last sexual assault that there's an employment relationship. That is a completely different claim than a failure to warn claim, unsuspecting plaintiffs out there, the third party plaintiffs that this court permits as viable claimants. And so this isn't a derivative claim in any sense. It's impossible to say that on the date of the sexual assault that our plaintiffs had knowledge or should be imputed with knowledge of the activities of the Diocese of Madison and Milwaukee. Yes.
May I just ask you something? We've struggled with fraud, which is an affirmative act, and negligence, which is at the other end of the spectrum, and you say that this is somewhere in the middle. And then you say this is a claim for failure to warn unsuspecting plaintiffs. You know, you wouldn't know who they are because they're, you know, out there someday, somewhere 30 years down the road or not, might come back and sue you. What I'm trying to figure out is if what you're really pleading and asking this court to accept and adopt is a strict liability claim.
Your Honor, no. We're not asking for strict liability. We're asking for a classic negligent failure to warn theory based on this complaint. Now, my colleague referred to the failure of pleading reliance. Reliance is not an element of duty to warn. It is an element of fraud, of misrepresentation to someone.
Counselor, where I'm having the most trouble with your complaint is that you're not saying they should have warned the plaintiffs, the kids who were injured. You're saying they should have warned the Archdiocese, right?
Your Honor, we're saying they should have warned with respect to
who?
All of the following. Those other dioceses within the United States and the parochial school system, they're all within a communication network.
Okay, so you're not saying they should have warned the plaintiff. You're saying they should have warned the Archdiocese in Kentucky, correct?
Or the parents.
How could they warn the parents? They wouldn't know who in the world would ever be students at the school, for goodness sakes.
All they would have to do is to provide the information to the principals to provide to the parents.
So what you're really saying is that they should have warned the Archdiocese, and then it was up to them to take affirmative steps to warn your client's parents. Is that what you're saying?
We're saying that the duty to warn goes to unforeseeable third parties under Wisconsin law.
Right, but the third parties in Wisconsin cases are the injured parties. You're saying they should warn someone who was not injured. The diocese in Kentucky was not injured by this man's acts. It was the children. But you're not arguing to us that we should give a duty to Milwaukee Archdiocese and Madison Archdiocese to warn the children. So to me, you're really stretching third-party liability. Now you warn the third party in the hope that somehow they're going to warn the fourth party, who is the injured party here?
Well, at this procedural stage, there's no reason to believe that they didn't warn the diocese in the school. We did not plead that there was no communication. We simply pled that there was communication publicly in this area. Now, we're only asking to survive a motion to dismiss.
You're getting off my problem, and it severely bothers me. You are not pleading to us third-party claim because the people that you say should be warned are not the injured persons. How are we to get, if we buy your theory and say there was a duty to warn the archdiocese, that doesn't mean that these children would still not have been subjected to exactly the same conduct that they were.
Well, then in that case, we would have an additional tortfeasor on that theory. But
you already sued the archdiocese down there for not preventing this harm, I understood.
With all due respect, this case procedurally is not where your questions are. Your questions go to the public policy when you decide recovery on the facts of this case that is a summary judgment motion or a trial issue. Now, California, the point was made very nicely here, in Randy W., California determines the public policy issues in the motion to dismiss right now. That's why that case comes down the way it does. This court does not do that kind of public policy analysis until facts have been found. We're dealing with a situation where not only do we not have discovery, we don't even have an answer.
Counselor, let me just put it to you this way. What if they warned the archdiocese, okay? And the archdiocese told the principal. And the principal told the parents. But a child came to school and visited one of the children whose parents were warned. And it was that child that was abused. You see what kind of a string you're setting up? I can understand third-party liability when the third party that you want to be warned is the injured person. Here, the third party you want to be warned is not the injured person. And you can make a string that will go on beyond my hypothetical ad infinitum, if we buy your theory.
Well, our theory is that the children actually should be warned. That
is your
that's
theory tied into the readily identifiable victim rule of law in Wisconsin?
Well, the rule in Wisconsin is that there is no requirement of a readily identifiable victim or plaintiff. This court has explicitly rejected that concept. Even though majority of jurisdictions accept that concept, the law schools teach that concept.
California has
California
that concept.
California falls it.
But we do not.
Wisconsin affirmatively rejects the idea that you are only liable to foreseeable plaintiffs. The court has repeatedly said there is liability to unforeseeable, and that's the language from the cases, plaintiffs.
She's not taking questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton.
Thank you.
And thank you, counsel, for both the Archdiocese of Milwaukee and Madison. Mr. Rothstein and Mr. Heaney, we appreciate yet another argument relating to liability under these circumstances of sexual assault and in a different fact pattern. That concludes our hearing in 2006, AP 291, Hornback versus Archdiocese of Milwaukee. The court's in recess until 1:30, and Justice Crooks will be out very promptly to talk to the students and anyone else who wishes to stay for the session. We're in recess for lunch.